Welcome to Not Quite Right. My name's Ed.
And I'm Amanda.
And we are back with another interview from Words on the Waves. And this time we are speaking with Sam Elliott. And Sam is at Words on the Waves as part of the Inked in Ash panel. And Sam shared with us his experience writing his two novels, Haze and Deepfake. So here is our interview with Sam Elliott. We are here at Words on the Waves with Sam Elliott. How are you, Sam?
I'm so good, Ed. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's awesome to be here.
And so what brings you here to Words on the Waves?
I am very fortunate. I was invited to appear on Inked in Ash, speaking with Jen Mills, Inga Simpson, and George Kemp about their works. So it's like just an absolute pleasure and privilege to be here. I'll be talking about my novel, Haze.
Excellent. So what's that panel? It's crime writing?
I think it's more talking about the Australian landscape and what sort of compels us to write about it, particularly in some different sort of depictions of that, be it a disaster, or I guess just essentially more broadly what draws us to writing about this, particularly with fires featuring throughout several of our works. So.
And your writing is set in Sydney, is that right?
The second book is set in Sydney. The first one, Haze, is set in a fictional South Coast town heavily inspired by where I used to spend my youth, which was Browley. So Browlet is the name of the fictional South Coast town, sort of around Batemans Bay area, It was inspired by the 2019-2020 sort of Black Summer fires that had threatened and consumed properties that had never been threatened before, as well as, you know, loss of life, loss of property, loss of livestock. So it was something in which is an unprecedented bushfire scale and what compelled me to pick up a pen and start writing Haze.
Do you have your own personal experience of that more as an observer, or was your own property threatened at that time?
I wasn't personally there. It wasn't my personal experience. It was more a case of my personal experience was here's this place that I associated with all these wonderful memories of a childhood, and then that was kind of like this paradise that had never been threatened before, Amanda, by bushfires. And then during this 2019-2020 period, there was all these places that had never been threatened before that were taken from that. So that was obviously hellish scenes that we all saw, and that's sort of what compelled me to write in that sort of capacity,
And that probably is something that is quite Australian, you know, the droughts and flooding rains and the fires. And I think it's something that as a nation we all sort of share, like our own personal history as associated with these big natural events, I suppose. So there's something about it that brings us together, I feel.
I agree. I think that also it's one of those things that's ever worsening, with climate change and stuff like that. Like every year, seemingly, the preceding year, it's worse than the preceding year in terms of unprecedented bushfires, unprecedented flooding, like all these sort of things that continue to happen and continue to get worse. And it is very Australian-centric, It's like something that's very inherent to this wonderful country of ours. And I think that does unify and unite people in terms of this sense of, I guess, an Australian mateship and togetherness. But, I mean, that's the most sort of hellish conditions you can experience is bushfires and this sort of stuff. And these brave few people that do go out, predominantly volunteers, to go and kind of contain this hellish, like, 100-foot wall of fire with some buckets of sand and some water. So, it's very Australian. Australian attitude in terms of the Australian in terms of the landscape, and Australian in terms of the attitude of trying to go up against these sort of awesome forces and hopefully prevail.
Yeah. So tell us a bit more about your book and what the themes it explores.
Okay, so Haze is set during an unprecedented bushfire season that's kind of besieged this small South Coast town called Browlet. We're introduced to Constable Dahlia Turner, who is conducting a series of door knocks on properties on the outskirts of town that are supposed to have been evacuated a day or so before. The last name on her list is her best friends, Callum and Xavier Vincent, and their son, Jude Vincent. She arrives just before the fires close in to find that her two best friends have been killed and their son is missing right before the fire sort of consumes the house, and she escapes in a way that I won't tell you and spoil for the readers. So then obviously the next day she wants to conduct the search or contribute to the search, given that it's her godson that is missing, and she's not really allowed to do that. She's kind of appointed as a glorified babysitter for a detective that's assigned from another case that's handed over to lead the investigation or search for Jude Vincent, Detective Florence Fowler. And quickly they discover that there's seeming evidence that this is part of the ongoing war that's happening between the two factions of Browlet. So there is on one side the town industrialist, sort of from a dynastic family, Hunter Rochford, and he is clashing with Fairchild Shaw, who is the matriarchal leader of a cult, the People's Cleansing Light, that live on the outskirts of town in a heavily fortified compound that Dahlia used to be a part of and spent her childhood in as well. Yeah.
So. Interesting. Some twists and turns by the sounds of things.
There is a few, yeah.
Yeah, and the fire makes a very dramatic backdrop for all of that.
Very much. Yeah. I mean, that was like essentially a fire really had to be part of the like a character in itself as well because of that. So, yeah, I guess sort of in the lead up to writing it as well, I was kind of amazed because what we talked about, Amanda, in terms of the fire being so Australian. It is such an Australian thing, but in terms of particularly from the crime sort of outback noir sort of things, I didn't actually encounter that many works that had sort of had either fire featuring as a main character or set against the backdrop of fire, bushfires. So I thought that that was a good gap in the market to kind of explore as well.
And that's how you think of it, fire being a major character?
Very much, very much. I should say as well, the People's Cleansing Light worship fire. So they kind of
feel
that fire is going to come and sweep through biblical fire and kind of remove the unbelievers and the true will ascend to heaven or something along those lines. So, you know, and then the townsfolk obviously then immediately blame them for a lot of these blazes because they're deliberately lit. So there's another factor that kind of adds to further conflict and pressure going on as well.
I mean, not to minimise it, it feels like it could work really well as like a season cliffhanger on Home and Away as well.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. The good old days.
Yeah.
When I used to watch Home and Away when there was floods and all that sort of stuff, people trapped in cars. And
yeah.
So, yeah, those are the good old days.
Bring back the glory
I wish. That's like the highest form of praise. It's like likening it to that because that's just like my childhood right there.
Absolutely.
So that's based on your childhood, you said, growing up in a Australian town.
Yes, absolutely.
Coastal town. And tell us about your Sydney series as well.
Okay, so this is I hope this isn't too much of a spoiler, but Dahlia Turner, the main character, a bit of an anti-hero, she survives and she comes back.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second book is set in Sydney with Dahlia Turner, in short, kind of going up against the Manosphere. So at the tail end of the last book, I don't think this is too much of a spoiler, but she makes a promise to her mother to kind of see what's happening with her niece, who's increasingly troubled. She has a very strained relationship with her sister, Heidi, who is the mother of Isla, the one in which is deteriorating. So she agrees to go to an event with Isla in Sydney, sort of set in a fictional Central Park shopping centre that is revealed to be an event for a sort of Andrew Tate type figure called Jackson Price, who is unveiling his touring schedule for Sydney, which happens to coincide with Fairchild Shaw, who's become somewhat of a feminist icon and celebrity and sort of the antithesis of everything in which the Manosphere stands for. So they are having alternating or coinciding events at the Darling Harbour Arena lead up to that. So while Dahlia and her niece are kind of witnessing this event, some of the Madonnas, which is a cell or an activist, depending upon who you look at, interrupt this event with fireworks, causing a stampede. As they do that, two people jump off the top floor of the shopping centre, revealed to be two young Sydneysiders, two young women that are not known to each other, seemingly not known to each other, but embroiled in what they believe to be this sort of Manosphere group targeting young women as well. So Dahlia is quickly uncovering that her niece is much more involved than she previously thought. And as the investigation continues in the lead up towards the climactic sort of end between these two events, kind of coinciding it, depending upon what Dahlia is going to find out and happening with her niece as well. So,
interesting to hear a man writing about the Manosphere. We talked to in previous years to Ashley Collegian Blunt, who writes about the Manosphere as well in a crime sort of setting. So I'm interested in what you wanted to say about that.
Well, I think that the Manosphere is something that kind of is on the rise. I don't think that it's kind of, I think people kind of laugh at it, and you kind of get these figures like Andrew Tate where people, because of what they say, it's so absurd and they're easy to dismiss. I think that that's they're alarming, and I think that Andrew Tate, perhaps he's had his time and his, you know, it's he doesn't have as much of a sort of following or he trends as much as he did. But I think that he exemplifies the kind of people that do rise up. So they flash in a pan because of how extreme they are. But when they're around, they command such clout and so much of an influence that that kind of thing can't be just laughed at and dismissed. And they always appeal, like any sort of despot, they always appeal to whom I believe is the people that are responsible for kind of like the world's worst, well, the history's worst travesties and atrocities is angry young men. So you appeal to this group of angry young men, and they're the ones that can, you know, lead an uprising and essentially can appoint you into a position of power. It's not too outrageous for this sort of thing to happen. I think this is the new generation that's experiencing this sort of thing. This is what this is now is what Hitler had with the brown shirts and then the Night of the Long Knives and sort of thing. I truly think that there's a line, direct correlation between the two.
I was going to say, I'm not sure if it's special to our time or if it's kind of a resurgent, because these figures that you're talking about, and they're compelling if you're not the kind of person who is attracted to them.
Yeah.
But they are very appealing to a certain kind of people. Definitely. But there seem to be a constant stream of these kinds of figures. I'm not sure if this is just the times that we live in or if it's always been like this and they're just...
Well, I guess the thing is now, and what people in the manosphere would say, is that men are feeling marginalised in a way that maybe they haven't felt in the past, and that's driving a lot of this pushback.
Definitely. Yeah. Adding on from what you're saying, I think there's a few different factors that are working there from me, from the outside kind of looking in. So I think that you have, a lot of disenfranchised, disillusioned young men that are feeling that they're being either replaced or they're being punished for their sort of perceived masculinity. Mm. So there's a, masculinity in crisis. So there's a fictional character that's kind of based on a sort of a Jordan Peterson type that kind of legitimized this sort of an era of academia. Mm. So they have a book out about masculinity in crisis, which kind of features in my novel as well. So that sort of adds this air of legitimacy of academia, like men perceiving that, masculinity is in crisis and all this sort of stuff, which is just really sort of hate speech and paves the way for groups of predominantly young men, but all the, this from all ages that then become this weaponized force. Mm. And then, so you've got that factor, but then you've also got the younger generations as well. So the Louis Theroux, new Louis Theroux Manosphere documentary recently, and how young people, young men in particular, idolize these fringe dwelling sort of thought leader guys. Yeah. All that sort of adds to it as well. So you've got real young guys, young or teenage boys or children being very impressionable and being very easily led by these sort of figures, all of which makes fertile ground for, I think, what deepfake, hopefully I've explored and kind of started a bit of a discourse, I don't know, like we're having right now.
Now, I understand you also write short fiction.
I do.
Yes, we're very interested in short fiction. We have a competition, short fiction competition. So you've published some collected stories.
I've had a few out in like The Big Issue and stuff like that.
Okay.
I've had one in The Southerly. I had one in Better Read Than Dead's inaugural anthology as well. Mm-hmm. So I have great love for the short story medium. Absolutely.
And do you typically write short crime fiction or?
Oh, I don't know if I'm good enough to write. I think that's hard. I think that's really hard, because short fiction, I think, is actually one of the most underrated and tough, actually, types of writing you could possibly do, because it's, by virtue of how short it is, it's actually hard to kind of achieve. And I feel like the best sort of short fiction is the one that you feel like you've only got a snapshot of a much bigger story, and then it keeps telling itself to you long after you finish reading that short story. I don't know.
But it still has to be satisfying within itself.
It still has
to
be satisfying within itself, yeah.
I think it is tough in particular for genre fiction to fit into short fiction. Definitely. So something like crime, where you need all that set up and it's all very character-driven and there's backstory, and that feeds into it, and all the twists and turns, is something that you can't really achieve in the shorter format. But you obviously like to write both.
Very much. Yeah. Of the short stories that I've had published, none of which I think have strayed into the crime too much, because it's like you said, like they, you need the conventions and you need the build up and stuff like that. Yeah. I think that the Sisters of Crime have a Stiletto Awards, like they have a short story competition of crime, but I'm yet to tackle that beast. I think it's a bit
a challenge for the future, perhaps.
Very much.
Well, thanks for chatting with us, Sam. And your books are called Haze and Deepfake.
Deepfake is to follow come publication time, Feb next year, if everything keeps going well.
Keeping those fingers crossed.
About to send the next draft back. Yeah, thank you so much. Excellent. Really appreciate it, Amanda.
This has been a special presentation of the Not Quite Right podcast in collaboration with Words on the Waves Writers Festival. Check the show notes for more information about Words on the Waves and the books mentioned in this episode. If you're new to the podcast, please join us again for our regular episodes where we talk about media, culture, and the art of writing.
Something doesn't seem quite right.